that supposed to be Saturday?
What day is it today?
Wednesday.
Exactly.
Hello, I'm not Glenn, Virat or Chris. The boys are taking a break this week. There'll be no fights tonight, just pleasant conversation. My name's Michael and I talk about films on 2SER's Breakfast Show. Tonight I'll be talking about a few movies you can catch on various streaming services.
Hi, this is Andre from The Space in Between. At 2SER, we're doing our best to keep you company during lockdown. So stay safe, look after yourselves and each other. You can tune in to The Space in Between at 107.3 on Tuesday nights at 10 p.m. or at any time at 2SER.com.
It is Movies with Michael time. It is 8:13 on your Thursday morning. Michael, how are you?
Pretty well, thanks. Willie, how are you going?
I'm good. I feel we've got a good one this week.
Well, I'm glad you feel that way. You might remember last week I said I expected the movie that I was talking about, that was Loco por Air, to be remade probably badly as an American film.
Yeah.
Remember I said that?
I don't remember you said that.
I watched this week's film, your suggestion, this one's called Coda, I immediately got a sense of deja vu. Yes, so I was watching an American remake of a French film called La Famille Bélier from 2014, which I think I even talked about back in 2014.
<Did you?
laughs> Right in these very studios. But let's talk about Coda. This one stars Emilia Jones, Marley Matlin. That's a familiar name. Did you ever see the film Children of a Lesser God?
No. Sounds a bit deep for me.
It might have been a bit before your time. No, maybe a bit before your time. Troy Kotsur, Daniel Durant is also in it. Written and directed by Sean Hayden. Coda recently screened at the Sundance Film Festival to much acclaim, and I guess fair enough too. Like I alluded to before, it's based on some pretty entertaining source material, that being La Famille Bélier. In this film, Coda has two meanings, one being a musical term for the concluding passage of a piece or movement, typically forming an addition to the basic structure, and the second being an acronym for a child of deaf adults. Which is exactly what 17-year-old Ruby, played by Emilia Jones, is. She lives with mum and dad Jackie and Frank, played by Matlin and Kotsur, and older brother Leo, played by Durant, who are all deaf. She divides her time between her final year of high school. Yes, there's going to be some drama there. Look out for that. Plenty of teen romance. And performing tasks on the family fishing trawler. That can only be done by a hearing person, like keeping in touch with the Coast Guard.
Listening for emergencies.
Yeah, the engine is still running properly, sort of stuff. And negotiating prices with dealers on shore. Unlike the French film where the Ruby character helped out on the family dairy farm.
Okay.
But Ruby loves to sing. It's a talent soon discovered by choirmaster Mr. Villalobos, played by Eugenio Derbez. He's tough, but of course, he has a heart of gold, and beneath that sort of bitchy, narky, flamboyant exterior, he encourages Ruby to audition for the Berklee Music School. Pursue her dreams.
Yes, pursue her dreams. I'm getting goosebumps. I've seen it, but I know the outcome. But
Well, like the original film, Coda is very much a feel-good box ticker that will gradually chip away at even the most hardened cynic, with perhaps an extra layer of American cheese and some sweet syrup just to distinguish it from the more organic, earthy French original. One major difference between Coda and La Famille Bélier was that three deaf actors were cast in the parts of Ruby's parents and older brother, unlike the original, which generated a lot of controversy, particularly amongst the deaf community, for not casting deaf actors in those roles. There's plenty to like about this film, apart from the comfort factor of already knowing where this film is going to end, particularly if you've seen the original one. Emilia Jones is extremely engaging and likable as the conflicted Ruby. Does she stay at home and help out with the family business, as she's always done, or does she pursue her own dreams?
Dilemma, dilemma.
So much dilemma for this main character. Emilia Jones can sing, but thankfully she doesn't have that high school musical vibe artifice about her. She seems much more earthy and less polished, almost like a real teenager, in fact.
Oh, my Lord. Yes. I know. Yeah, like a real teenager, not like all glossy.
Yeah, look, apparently Emilia Jones spent 9 months learning sign language, perfecting an American accent, and learning to sing for the part, which did seem a bit odd to me, given that she's the daughter of acclaimed Welsh boy soprano Aled Jones. Never heard of him. Alan Jones was a big fan of his work. Surely there must have been some singing at home when she was growing up.
There would have been. But, you know, I mean, her voice is amazing, so I'm surprised to hear that it is her voice.
Oh, it's very much her voice, yes.
Yeah, okay.
The characters of Ruby's parents are also well fleshed out too. You know, they really love her daughter. They want to succeed, and they have their own lives too. They're engaged in the family business. But they've also relied on Ruby for so long, they don't really know how to let her go.
I know the dynamic between like Ruby and her parents is really interesting, but then the dynamic between Ruby and her older brother is really interesting as well.
That's a good one too. I mean, he loves his younger sister, but he's also a very, very frustrated young man because he feels that his parents don't respect him and don't trust him with his ideas for the family business. Yeah. It's quite an interesting dynamic, that one too. And especially she has an interesting dynamic with her mother who interprets her love of singing as an act of defiance. And in one scene, she even asks Ruby that if she were blind, would she have chosen to paint?
Yes.
It's almost like she's rubbing this extra sense in their faces. Yeah. You know? Even if it wasn't a remake, Coda, like a well-crafted melody, has a predictability about it. I suppose there is great comfort in familiarity. Throw in some teen romance, some earthy humour, particularly generated by the parents, and a tearjerker of a Joni Mitchell song, Both Sides Now. For a lockdown audience looking for some inspiration and escape, Coda plays like a well-loved tune that hits all the right notes, so much so that you could almost sing along to it.
Oh, Michael Jones, yes. Do you know any deaf people?
Not at the moment.
Okay. I have a cousin who was born deaf, mm-hmm. and there's a great movie as well called The Sound of Metal. I don't know if you saw that or reviewed that at all.
I saw it a while back. Okay. Yeah.
And what I was going to say is I'm one of the parts I found really effective in Coda was when they are sitting in the audience listening. Mm. Well, Ruby's parents are sitting in the audience, right? And Ruby's on stage and they turn all the sound down. Mm. So you're actually just sitting there in silence as her parents would be. And I found that just a fantastic way for people to get even the slightest sense of what it must be like.
Yeah, that was a good part. And the way they look around to see how the hearing audience are actually appreciating what she's doing.
Yeah.
And then at the end, again, and the mother seems almost reluctant to get enthusiastic about it.
Yeah, because she's like, how will we know if she's good?
That is quite an amazing scene.
Yeah. Oh, Michael, I love that one. Good work. Good work.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. I think I'm going to go for something that you'll find a little bit more challenging next week.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Hey, thank you so much for that.
Pleasure.
2SCR 107.3, FM, DAB, on demand, live stream and app.
It is time for Movies with Michael. Michael, how are you?
Great, thanks, Willie. How are you?
I'm good. I'm so sorry I didn't watch the movie last night. I had work. I know. I let the team down because it actually, to me, it looks really good.
Well, I'm glad it looks really good to you, Willie. Look, the last few films I've talked about over the last few weeks have actually made me feel something. So today I thought I'd return to a much safer genre for me. The action thriller, which means I don't necessarily have to feel things.
Emotions. Ooh, no, no.
Still well clear of those. Now, this is the second joyless, confusing movie that I've seen starring John David Washington in the last 12 months.
Oh, God, rough start. Poor John.
The other one being Tenet. That was also really confusing. And this one was a bit all Greek to me as well, given that it's even actually set in Greece. Look, this one is called Beckett. And like I said, it stars John David Washington. He's been in movies like Black Klansman, Tenet, and he's also the son of Denzel Washington.
Is he?
He is.
Oh.
So if the voice sounds a bit familiar, that's why. Boyd Holbrook is in this film. He was in Narcos, the TV series.
And is she from The Dutch Girl?
The girl, Vicky Krieps, is a Dutch girl, but she was in Phantom Thread and Old. And there's another European woman in this film, Alicia Vikander. She's actually Swedish, and she was in Ex Machina, or Ex Machina, I'm not sure how you pronounce that, and Testament of Youth.
I'm thinking of the one with Danish Eddie Redmayne.
The Danish girl.
The Danish girl.
That's the one she was in.
Okay, yeah. What did I say?
The Dutch girl. There's also a bunch of Greek actors that you've never heard of before, but you might just see their faces pop up in films in future. Look, this one's directed by a guy called Ferdinando Chito Filomarino. There we go. Antonia being his only previous feature. Now, Beckett, played by Washington, and girlfriend April, played by Vikander, are on holidays. They're driving through the mountainous Greek countryside. But April doesn't like to wear seatbelts.
Bad April.
Well, it's going to turn out pretty bad for April. So when Beckett falls asleep at the wheel, tragedy ensues. Now, before losing consciousness, Beckett thinks he sees a young boy, which he tells the local cops about when he regains consciousness. Big mistake. Now, Beckett is in the middle of something he doesn't, and the viewer doesn't really, understand at all. The cops, or whoever they are, want him dead, and Beckett has to make it safely to the US embassy, which is about 5 hours away by car in Athens.
Okay.
The ordinary man caught up in a political conspiracy chain of events that he doesn't really understand is a fairly common premise for the thriller genre. And apart from the fairly graphic message about the dangers of riding in a motor vehicle without a seatbelt, this film adds very little to that. As usual, no police can be trusted, and even corrupt US embassy staff seem to be involved. Despite appearing to be the only black man in Greece, Beckett is able to somehow evade detection and capture for long parts of the film. I found this quite odd. You know, the film is set around 2008 and 2009. I thought Greece was slightly more ethnically diverse than that.
Okay, yeah,
but
yeah.
John David Washington is the only black man on screen
the entire time.
Even in crowded scenes.
Yeah, okay.
There must be some people of African origin in Greece, I'm sure. Whilst Greece does make an interesting backdrop, the film is set against a backdrop of widespread anti-government and anti-austerity protests around 2008, 2009. Greece also is a very interesting location for a thriller aimed at an English-speaking audience.
Do you wonder if they got some tax breaks or something?
Oh, God. tax break?
And a trip to Greece?
Well, you've got Greece and tax breaks. Look, there is some pretty spectacular scenery captured by the cinematographer. And it's also nice to see some different faces in the film as well that you wouldn't normally see in an action thriller. Look, unfortunately, most of the action sequences in this film are fairly run-of-the-mill for an action thriller, apart from one ridiculous sequence where one character jumps onto a car from a roof from about four stories above the ground and actually survives. That being the only action sequence here, wow, that's kind of amazing. Look, John David Washington, he goes okay in the lead role as Beckett, but there's nothing at the beginning of the film to suggest that this guy is capable of transforming from lazy boyfriend to crusading action hero. Maybe that was the point of the film, but there's never anything about his character, apart from his predicament, being the ordinary man in the extraordinary situation, that really made you want to root for him. The pacing of this film is also a little off. I mean, whilst thrillers these days are more often a crazy sprint, this movie kind of plods along more like a marathon.
The trailer looks really good.
That's the idea of trailers. They're there to suck you in.
Am I basically seeing the movie in that trailer? Is that all the high-octane action?
And another thing about this, the real Achilles heel of this film is the general sense of hopelessness and the lack of joy of this film. Maybe I've been watching too many joyful films over the last few weeks, and it's affected me. Any satisfaction the viewer gets at the dispatch of a few of the baddies is tempered by the fact that we find out that they're very low on the totem pole of the political criminal conspiracy.
Oh my God, so do we not get, like, does the movie not conclude with some satisfactory win for the viewer?
Yeah, well, you get one villain's explanation reveal of events towards the end that is a real letdown and really contributes to an underwhelming climax. I'm sure there is an entertaining political thriller set in Greece to be made, but Beckett...
but this was not it.
Beckett definitely isn't it. I just didn't get it. It was all Greek to me.
Oh, Michael. Oh, my God. Okay, well, I looked at the trailer and was like, yes, I'm going to try and watch it. And then last night I didn't get around to it. But, okay, I'm going in with low expectations, maybe. But I feel like my movie expectations are generally a lot lower than yours.
I don't know about that. I've seen some pretty awful movies.
Yeah, I know, but you have not liked them. Whereas I feel like my expectations of movies are, they're not as high as yours.
You're much more easily pleased.
That's it. Michael, thank you so much. much for that. We'll see you next week.
Pleasure.
G'day, this is Mick Rad from The Tuck Shop. At 2SER, we're doing our best to keep you company during lockdown.
I sit down, turn the page over.
Stay safe, look after yourselves and each other. You can tune in to The Tuck Shop for 2 hours of all Australian music on 107.3 at 6 o'clock every Sunday night or at 2SER.com. See you soon at The Tuck Shop.
Now, it's that time of the morning. We're joined through a couple of COVID-safe panes of glass by Michael Jones. This is for Movies with Michael. What do you got for us this morning, Michael?
Morning, Jared. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
You enjoying breakfast so far?
I am. It's lovely. It's nice to be up this early. I was a barista in a past life, so it's a little while since I've gotten up at Sparrow Farts, but it's good. It's a whole different world out there, isn't it?
I haven't done that. This is a pretty early morning for me. So
fair enough.
8 o'clock. I've been randomly dipping into the streaming space for obvious reasons for the past few weeks. And I was expecting a fairly wishy-washy teen comedy when I stumbled across Sweet Girl,
yes,
which is the film we're going to talk about today. But then I noticed that it starred Jason Momoa.
Yes.
And my spidey senses, or my action film senses, started to tingle. And I was rewarded somewhat. But
yes,
I do have a few things to say about Sweet Girl. Apparently, you've watched about half of Sweet Girl, haven't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, so I got the first little bit of it. I thought the same thing. Within 30 seconds, I thought I definitely knew what I was in for here. And it did switch a couple of times throughout, even within like the kind of half an hour to 40 minutes that I saw. So I am intrigued to hear a little bit more from yourself.
Okay, like I was saying, this one stars Jason Momoa. He's been in movies like Aquaman, and he was in the remake of Conan the Barbarian a few years ago. Did you ever catch that one?
No, I didn't. But I know of Jason. He's a tall drink of water, that
guy. Tall drink of water. That was something that had me asking a few questions. I'm not sure if he wears lifts. He just seems to have this really awkward way of walking, and he's always wearing these very large boots.
What are lifts?
Lifts. They're things you put inside your shoes to make yourself look just a little bit taller.
Is that the kind of vanity we normally associate with Hollywood movie stars, though? Would they go so far as to make themselves look taller?
I think you'll find Sylvester Stallone is a bit notorious for wearing lifts. But Jason Momoa, on his IMDb profile, is allegedly 195 centimetres tall. So who am I to question that? Well, I'm getting distracted. Isabelle Merced is in this film. She's been in sweet movies like Dora the Explorer and The Lost City of Gold and Instant Family. She is the sweet girl in this movie. Manuel Garcia Rulfo, who's in The Magnificent Seven, Justin Bartha, Amy Brenneman, Lex Scott Davis also feature. This film is directed by Brian Andrew Mendoza. This is his debut feature. Now, Ray Cooper, played by Momoa, is enraged when his beloved wife dies of cancer because the BioPrime drug company, headed by CEO Simon Keeley, who's played by Bartha, whose resemblance to real-life drug company CEO Martin Shkreli is beyond coincidental. Do you remember Martin Shkreli?
I do remember.
Yes.
Of buying Wu-Tang Clan record for millions and millions fame.
Well, he's also notorious for being the CEO of a drug company that raised the price of an anti-parasitic drug called Daraprim from $13.50 to $750 per pill.
My God. It's unfathomable, isn't it?
I think he's currently residing in a federal prison somewhere in the United States, so he did get his just desserts. But anyway, I getting distracted. So this Simon Keeley character, he refuses to allow the manufacture of a generic brand of the wonder drug that the BioPrime company has developed. So that's why Ray Cooper's wife dies. Cooper is left with teenage daughter Rachel, played by Merced, who he has trained to be independent, tough and resourceful. And, of course, he vows revenge on Keeley. But one day Cooper is approached by a journalist who says he has evidence of dirty dealings by BioPrime. But their meeting is interrupted by the enigmatic knife-wielding Santos, played by Garcia Rulfo, who stabs both men. Of course, now the quest for revenge is on in earnest, and a lot of very bad people are going to have their lives dramatically shortened in the most violent of waves. possibly at the hands of Jason Momoa. The first 2.5 acts of this film are pretty enjoyable for a straight-to-streaming action thriller. Like, there's obviously a bit of a conspiracy going on and there's a bit of mystery thrown in. Are Ray Cooper and Rachel involved in something that they'll never quite be able to escape from? Will they be on the run for the rest of their lives? What did you think?
I saw the first 40 minutes. I saw the stabbings. Too many spoilers, but you just said knife wielding, couple of stabbings. My viewing buddy, that was enough for them. So I thought I'm going to have to come back to this one. But I am intrigued. It did hook me.
The more I think about this, I think you should bring your viewing buddy back and make them sit through the rest of the film because I think they might be pleased. But another thing, I really enjoyed the father-daughter dynamic in this film. It's quite interesting. Ray Cooper, he's obviously raised Rachel to think for herself and to be able to defend herself, yet he doesn't trust her to help in his quest for revenge. He does like to practice irresponsible parenting 101. It's also nice to see Jason Momoa emoting in this film. For a fairly limited actor, he's certainly doing his best here. Mm. Rachel, in turn, is probably the more responsible one of the pair, constantly trying to reason with Dad and talk him into a more sane course of action. And speaking of action, that's mostly pretty slick, I thought. I particularly enjoyed that fight scene that takes place on the train where the two stabbings you mentioned.
Yes.
Well, I think I mentioned them.
It comes out pretty quickly. It comes out of nowhere. We do have to move on pretty soon, Michael.
Sure. Brutal and not totally unrealistic. And there are one or two very satisfying homicides that will leave action fans punching the air and screaming, yes. But that's all the stuff I really liked about this film. Remember I said it was enjoyable, fairly predictable for the first 2.5 acts. Well, there is a twist in the film that comes a little further than 45 minutes in. A twist that it was a little too wacky for me to believe, and especially when the film does a quick flashback. I kept thinking back to some of those action sequences and just went, nah. Couldn't happen. And the climactic fight scene is pretty ridiculous. I would back the hardened professional killer every time in that scenario. And the corruption conspiracy theory subplot was never really explained satisfactorily to me. Sweet Girl, it tries to be a bit too cute and clever and just doesn't quite pull it off for me. It's a bit like a lolly that runs out of flavour if you suck it too long.
There you go. Well, that's Sweet Girl. You said it was a debut there, so hopefully in said director there's a little bit more. I'm going to watch the last little bit of it or the last hour or so of it because, as I said, I was hooked. But thank you very much, Michael, for joining us. That was Movies with Michael.
Pleasure.
You're listening to 2SER 107.3 FM, DAB, on demand, live stream, and app.
We're joined through a couple of COVID-safe panes of glass by Michael Jones. This is for Movies with Michael. How's it going, Michael?
Pretty well, Jared. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I'm good. Thank you for asking. So,
excellent.
Of course, we've got a film review here. It was a good one. I sat down and I got through the whole lot yesterday. It was good stuff. What is it?
You've already told us it was good. Maybe I just need to stop talking right now.
No. We want to. You're so much more eloquent than I. When I watch a film, it's merely me just sitting in front of a film. Despite the fact that I studied film or did some courses at uni, I don't have the ability to pick them apart. Outside of, I like that actor. Oh, that was good performance. Wasn't mad about that dialogue. Exposition there, fantastic. Outside of that, I'm a goner. So I need you here to tell us a little more.
No, you don't. You've pretty much nailed it there as far as talking about movies on radio. I think I can just turn off my mic right now. Yes, this film is quite a good one. It's called Worth, and I think it's quite worthy of spending some time in front of the TV maybe this weekend. It stars Michael Keaton. Apparently, he's one of your favourite actors.
Yeah, of Batman fame.
Batman fame. Some of his earlier work includes Mr. Mom and Night Shift. Did you ever catch those films?
I haven't heard of it, no.
I think you should go into his back catalogue.
All right,
look at them. The Founder is also one of my favourite Michael Keaton films. Amy Ryan is also in this one. She was in Birdman with Michael Keaton just a few years ago. Bridge of Spies is another one she's been in. Another favourite actor of mine is Stanley Tucci. He's most recently been in films like The Hunger Games, Supernova, and he's in a film that I'll be talking about next week called Jolt.
Oh, I'm excited for that one.
Jolt. I don't know that you should be.
Okay.
Tate Donovan, Shinori Ramanathan, and Talia Balsam also feature. This film is directed by Sarah Colangelo, who's made films like The Kindergarten Teacher and Little Accidents. Based on experiences recounted in Kenneth Feinberg's book, What is Life Worth? Worth tells the story of Ken Feinberg, played by Michael Keaton, who was appointed Special Master of the September 11 Victims Compensation Fund back in late 2001.
Yep.
Basically, his job was to come up with an appropriate monetary figure for each victim to prevent the US government and the airlines from being sued for billions and thus crippling the US economy.
Yes.
Ken and his team, led by Camille, played by Ryan, and Assistant Priya, played by Ramanathan, they come up with a mathematical formula to determine how much each victim is worth and what they'll get. But unsurprisingly, the victims' families, led by Charles Wolfe, Stanley Tucci, who's a bit of an activist, they just don't go for it. And for a long time, Ken just doesn't understand why they're resisting.
And what happens next then, Michael?
What happens next? Well, maybe I should just tell you the whole story. Look, Ken needs to get 80% of these victims' families on board by the deadline, which is sometimes set in
18 months or something, I think.
Late 2003 was the deadline. And you just wonder, how's he going to do it? Because early on, the film establishes Keaton Feinberg as a single-minded numbers man, or possibly even slightly autistic, obsessed with precision and punctuality and getting a deal done at all costs where neither party is too hurt by the outcome. Dry mathematical formula, solve all problems. And he's also a really poor communicator, which seems unusual for a mediation expert.
For someone familiar with the law, and for someone that from the first couple of scenes is an academic and sits in front of classes of, do you know what I mean?
Because he seems so articulate in that scene.
He does.
And then there's another scene in the film.
He's just forced to peace.
Yeah, he just craps himself. On the other side, there's Tucci's Charles Wolfe, who seems to be much more articulate and well-spoken. And it takes him and a few other victims to make Ken realise that there's much more to compensation than just a dollar amount.
Mm-hmm.
But again, in this film, you sort of wonder how he actually goes about doing that, because we don't see enough scenes of Charles Wolfe convincing Ken Feinberg for mine in this one. Did the real Kenneth Feinberg really undergo such a moral odyssey whilst dealing with this case? I think probably not. I suspect Keaton's portrayal of Feinberg, thick Boston accent and all, is a slightly simplified version of a much more complex real-life man.
Mm.
Look, Tucci's Charles Wolfe is, of course, he's the catalyst for Feinberg finding his moral compass, but it would have been nice to see more of how he did it. There are a couple of pivotal scenes which are all very civil, which is kind of typical of Stanley Tucci's work, between Feinberg and Wolfe. But Wolfe was actually highly critical. I did a bit of research into him. He was highly critical of the initial offer of compensation to the victim. And he came up with many suggestions that were actually eventually adopted, but this film doesn't show any of the negotiations.
That's a shame.
Between Wolfe and Feinberg's team, which I think possibly could have made it a bit more interesting.
Yeah, absolutely, as well.
Look, if you are a fan of both the softly spoken style of Tucci and the more in-your-face sort of gruff acting style of Keaton, I think you'll find a lot to like about this film, which enlivens some fairly dry subject matter. It does start out as a legal procedural, but does eventually, I guess, evolve into a more human drama of a man learning to find empathy. Warning, there is a bit of grief porn in this film, so maybe have some tissues handy.
Yeah, so I'm an easy cry in films, and I blub it a couple of times, I must admit.
Look, but I don't think you can tell a story revolving around 9/11 without some of that stuff. You'll definitely find this film much more intellectually and emotionally stimulating than last week's Sweet Girl. And I'd say worth spending an hour and 58 minutes of your time.
I would think so as well. I did quite enjoy it. Similar to you, I thought some of the narrative arc was there for me. Some of the character development wasn't. Even similar to Keaton, in those first couple of scenes, he says this, and again, it seems like exposition of sorts, where it was to the effect of, it's just about the bottom line, anything to get to the point. It's to that effect, and he says it very vehemently, and you think, oh, geez, that's going to come back and slap you back in the face. And it does, but it doesn't slap. It more just caresses him with a wet piece of lettuce at the end. You think that's going to be the pivotal kind of shift of character. In any case, I don't want to poo-poo it too much because I did enjoy it. It's called Worth. Mm. And thank you so much for joining us this morning, Michael. I will just ask you while I've got you as well. I asked the listener before, I got some texts in. What's a film or a TV series that is part of like the zeitgeist? Everyone seems to know, whether it be a blockbuster stunner or a cult classic that you'd never seen and you kind of had to tinkle around it in conversation with friends to admit that you hadn't seen it and seem like a philistine of sorts. What's a film that you've since watched during this lockdown period?
It's one that I still have to tiptoe around is Breaking Bad.
Never seen it.
Even my dad has watched Breaking Bad.
It is good. I must admit, it is quite good. I was saying before, last night I watched A Girl with a Dragon tattoo.
Which version?
I don't know. Which one? Is there a Swedish version?
There is a Swedish version.
No, I watched the US production. It was quite good.
I think you should watch the Swedish version. It does follow the book a little bit more closely.
Okay, I'll give that one a read. Thank you very much, Michael.
Pleasure.
I appreciate your time as always. Pleasure. I'll speak to you next week.
You're listening to 2SER 107.3. FM, DAB, on demand, live stream and app.
Thanks for listening. Film Fight Club will return in its usual format next week.